work worth doing is worth doing right. And, you know, I don't remember so much of my upbringing. You know, I mean, as parents, you know, now as a parent, I'm like, I don't know how it's coming in one ear and going out the other, right, with the kids most of the time. But that's something at 11 years old I've never forgotten. I think about it all the time. It influences everything that I do, and it's not just work.
My name is Matt Bros with Lockton, and I have been so fortunate in my life to be surrounded by some really awesome people. So I want to be able to get their stories out there so that we can all learn from them together. Welcome to the Excellence Culture. Well, welcome to the Excellence Culture. Again, my name is Matt Brost, and again, I am super excited about the guests that I get to have here today. Many of you, if you're in the DFW Metroplex, and if you've sat by a fire, a solo stove fire, you probably, this name might be familiar to you. It's John Maris. John, thank you so much for joining us here on the Excellence Culture. Really appreciate it. And I know you're kind of like in a time of transition right now. So if I was to meet you at a soccer game and say, what do you do? What would you say?
Gosh, I would probably say I'm a little league coach. I'm a dad. I'm a husband. But, you know, from a professional career standpoint, you know, just transformational growth-minded leader. That's really been my entire career. And, you know, regardless of whether it was Solo Stove or Solo Brands or one of my prior endeavors, it's always been focused on growth and leadership.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So John was the former CEO of Solo Stove, and wonderful job there. When did you start at Solo Stove?
Yeah, I was there in October of 2018.
And so I can only, because I didn't really know what Solo Stove was then. Now I do now, and I have one myself. So significant amount of growth, obviously. I can't imagine that the pandemic was a bad thing for Solo Stove. So you were obviously a really great steward of the company during that period of time.
Yeah, it was a period of time that was, you know, even prior to the pandemic, we were growing, you know, no pun intended, like wildfire. It was, we finished 2018 at about $16 million of revenue. And then over the next several years, went from $16 million to $500 million of revenue. Over that three and a half, 4 year period. And so it was just a wild ride, tons of growth, and it shifted from a demand issue. We had plenty of demand to more of an operations challenge, right? And figuring out how to figure out supply chain, figure out product, and all during the pandemic when, you know, getting product from overseas was more challenging. But it was just an amazing experience. I'm so grateful for the time that I had there for 5 years.
That's awesome. Well, I don't want this conversation to be too much about Solo Stove because I think there's probably a lot more to you than that. And so, yeah, for sure. And honestly, we haven't gotten to know each other a whole lot. Most of the time that I've had these conversations, it's somebody I know really well. And we've had some opportunity to talk prior to this. But I want to hear your story, you know, when it comes down to it. Awesome. And so if it's okay, I'd like to kind of start like, little John Maris. Tell me about him as a kid, the upbringing you had. Yeah. Let's start there.
I love it.
Yeah.
So probably the most important thing of all the things to know about me from an upbringing. And by the way, I really appreciate being able to start here because I'm a big believer that your formative years, you know, when you're a kid are really what make you into who you become. And that people don't change a lot as adults. You know, they progress and they improve, hopefully, but most of who you are kind of you become, you know, when you're young. But the most important thing to know about me is that I have four sisters, three older and one younger. And so I like to say that I was raised by five moms, and that is the truth. And, you know, there were times that it was a real drag as a kid, especially with three older sisters, and one younger, but, I'll tell you, I look back on it now and, you know, I am so grateful. Moms just have a special place in my heart, right? I have five kids and my wife is an incredible mother. And I just think about...
Did you hear that? Five kids. That's...
Five kids. Yeah. And I just think about how hard it is to raise one, much less five for my wife. And I had the good fortune of really having five moms that helped raise me and brought me up right, taught me to respect the things that you should respect and to honor the things that you should honor and try to live the best type of life that you can. And so, you know, as a kid, I had a lot of female influence around me. My dad and I were really close as well, which is like a double benefit. I had five moms, but then I also had this really tight relationship with my dad as the only boy. When I was 11, we adopted my little brother from Thailand. So he was a newborn. So he was about 10 years younger than me, a little over 10 years younger than me. But for many, many years, I was the only boy. And my dad and I were kind of thick as thieves as the male, the men in the house, the male influence in the house. And then I had my sisters. We lived in Austin. I grew up in Austin. But when I was 11 years old, my mom had this dream of living on a ranch, living in the country. My dad was a businessman. He was a very white collar guy. Nothing real rugged about him. I don't even know
what
if he could.
What type of business was?
He was career Amway. So this is like multi-level marketing at its finest. He ended up being an investor in a variety of other things, but he just, even to this day, probably couldn't fix a leak in the sink or whatever. He just wasn't a very hands-on guy, but man, he loved to talk to people. But I was, you know, because of that dynamic, when I was 11, we moved out to the country. My dad had made enough money that he could buy my mom that country residence that she wanted. And we moved onto a 50-acre Longhorn cattle ranch. We had a few horses, and I had three sisters older than me, one younger, and my dad didn't want to lift a finger on the ranch. So that kind of all fell to me to an extent. And so I got put to work at a young age on the ranch. Because of my dad's kind of career path, it was one of those dynamics when my dad and I were, you know, at the grocery store, at the restaurant, he was just always recruiting. Yeah. And so no matter where he went, he was talking. It didn't matter who it was. It could be the cashier at Tom Thumb or whatever it might be. And he would be out there, you know, recruiting people into his Amway business and whatever. So quite an interesting upbringing. But really, the formal part of my upbringing was being raised on that ranch and having the opportunity to really get my hands dirty and go out and work, learn to drive a tractor at a young age and fixing fences and wrangling in, you know, the Longhorn cattle calves that got out and having to get them back in before school started. You know, they got in, you got out overnight and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was my upbringing.
Yeah, I've had, so far, you know, of the, I guess, 14 episodes we've done so far, two of them, Levi, the one that I was talking to you about, Franklin Building Supply CEO, he grew up on a ranch right outside Austin, right by the old South Salt Lick.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
And then Robert Henson, who works for Workday, he grew up on a ranch too. Both of them just very driven people. So I can see how that's a big part of your story.
Big time. I've told this story before, but it's worth noting. You know, when I was 11 years old, first day of summer, my dad calls me down. I come downstairs and he said, "Hey, yeah, I've got a project for you. I got a job for you to do." And I said, okay, you know, it's fine. Always happy to help out. And he grabs a 5-gallon bucket of white paint and a paintbrush. And we start walking up the driveway. And I kind of knew as we were walking up there what was coming. We had about a quarter mile of picket fence in front of our house, spanned the entire length of our property. And we got out there and he said, "Listen, I want you to paint this fence white. And your summer will start when you're done." Man, I was not happy. He just turned around and started walking back. We had a really long driveway, and I could see him kind of just getting smaller and smaller as he's walking back to the house. And I'm sitting up there, and I probably sat and mumbled and groaned and complained for about 15 minutes and finally realized this fence isn't going to paint itself. Yeah. So I guess the sooner I start, the sooner I get out of here. So I start painting. It took me 3 weeks. Painting that fence front
serious?
And back, three
wow.
weeks. I kept waking up earlier and earlier. I'm 11 years old. I've set my own alarm, getting out of bed before the sun comes up. It's Texas. It's hot. It's the summer. And so the earlier I start, right, then I can finish a little bit earlier. And so I normally would start about 6 a.m. and I'd wrap up about noon or 1 o'clock when it just got too hot to stay out there. And I finish in 3 weeks. I'm pretty proud of my work, right? I mean, at the beginning, it was a real drag. And then as I'm getting closer and closer finishing, I'm really excited about it. So I run down the driveway and I go grab my dad when I finish and my chest is kind of out and I'm like, "I'm done." And he's like, "Well, let's go look at it, you know?" And so we walk back out there and right when we get there, He, without saying a word, my dad just kind of crouches down on his knees and he starts doing this, and I know exactly what he's doing. He's looking to see if I painted the bottom of the 2x4s on the fence. And
so the 2x4s that go across, like, wow.
No 11-year-old, in fact, no adult, I don't think, would have painted the bottom of those stupid 2x4s. And my stomach just sank. And he said, I thought you said you were done. And I was like, I am done, you know. And he's like, well, you missed the bottom. And he just started walking back to the house. And I was so upset. Started crying. I'm 11 years old. And, you know, again, about 10, 15 minutes go by, and I'm realizing bottom of the fence rung isn't going to get painted unless I start. So I start going. It took me another couple weeks. And all I'm doing the whole time is thinking how much faster it would have been if I would have just been painting that as I was going. But now I've got to walk all the way down and get the bottom of them. And it took me two or three more weeks. I go back to the house. Now I'm a little bit nervous. I'm gun-shy. I'm like, oh, he's going to find something else. So I go get him. He comes back out. He looks underneath, inspects it. Everything's fine. He looks at me. He says, I just want you to remember this one thing. Work worth doing is worth doing right. Mm. And, you know, I don't remember so much of my upbringing. You know, I mean, as parents, you know, now as a parent, I'm like, I don't know how it's coming in one ear and going out the other, right, with the kids most of the time. But that's something at 11 years old I've never forgotten. I think about it all the time. It influences everything that I do. And it's not just work. It's relationships. Yeah. It's your marriage. It's being a father. It's, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And I pause all the time in my daily life as I'm doing things, and that lesson just comes to mind, and I just do a little bit more, put a little bit more effort in, or put a little bit more care or thought into what I'm doing from that one lesson at 11 years old. I'll just never be able to do anything different.
Well, I think your dad may have just defined excellence, you know, when you think about it. And I remember I was a GM of a country club about 13 years ago, and we would have, you know, kids from high school come and work in the cart barn. And you could just tell you had some kids that just naturally just cared about what they did, but then you had a lot of kids that didn't. Yeah. And that was kind of the conversation I tried to have with them. Like your dad did it in a much more eloquent way, but is, you know, what you're doing now is setting the foundation of who you're going to be in the future. And so awesome that your dad did that at such an early age. And I bet you know, you're thankful for it now too, right?
Oh, I mean, yeah. It's still to this day. And it's funny that you talk about caring, the word care, yeah. Because I say all the time, you can't make someone care. Yeah. You know, I've been CEO now, I've been a leader, you know, some sort of business leader for the last 15 years, and I've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of people work for me. And some people care and some people don't. It's not just teenagers. It goes all the way through, and it's really interesting to watch. But it doesn't matter how much money you pay somebody, people care or they don't. It's just kind of inherent in who they are. And that's one of the lessons I'm really trying to teach my kids, my own kids, is nobody can make you care. Yeah. They'll pay you for your job, but if you care, that comes from within. Yeah. Be a caring person, yeah. Whether it's with humans, whether it's with work, whether it's whatever, right? Just care, yeah. Because you'll get a lot farther in life caring.
Yeah, and your life will have more joy, have more meaning, all those things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 100%.
That's good. Okay, so that was 11 years old, right?
Yeah.
I think you said. Were you playing sports at all growing up?
Yeah, I started playing soccer when I was 5 years old. Loved all sports, so I really played everything, baseball, football, tennis, soccer, all the way through junior high. And then as I was approaching high school, got to a place where the coaches were starting to try to, like, narrow you down, right? I mean, I grew up in Texas. I lived out in the sticks, but the closest 5A school was Georgetown High School, and that's where I went to high school. And so it was a larger high school, even though I lived out in the country. We would drive about 15 miles to get to school. I think my graduating class was, like, 600, so about 2,500 kids in school.
Can I ask you what year you graduated?
In 01.
Okay.
2001, so.
Yeah, I'm older than you.
So probably not by much. So in any case, I get to high school and it was kind of narrowed down, and our high school had a great soccer program at the time, the few years that I was going to be there. We had a couple of kids that ended up going to Europe and playing and stuff. And so I chose soccer and kind of stuck with that through high school. Ended up being able to, you know, participate in the state tournament and that kind of thing my junior, senior year. But from the time I was 5 years old, I was playing on team sports for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. So any specific thing that you would say, even maybe you lean on your experience that you had as a kid, but you also are going through it with through your kids right now. Just I've had a lot of conversations with athletes on here or people that used to play sports. And it seems like just sport is, like, from a performance standpoint, creates a huge foundation for people too. So
there's no doubt. And I have often thought to myself, I'm a pretty competitive guy. Yeah. And I don't know if sports pulled out the competitiveness or I was drawn to sports because I was competitive. You know, I'm not sure how much of that is learned versus, you know, acquired or something that you're born with. But gosh, I've always loved sports for the competitive nature of them, and not even necessarily just always against the other team, but against yourself. I remember working so hard the summer between my freshman and my sophomore year because I wanted to make varsity so badly as a sophomore. And the work ethic that it kind of instilled in me, because I just wanted more. I wanted to be the best version of myself. And I think that that's, for me, what sports has done for me is it's just helped me to focus on potential. I think about the word potential all the time. You know, everybody's blessed with different, yeah, God-given, 100%. You know, abilities and whatnot. And not everybody was built the same, and nor is it supposed to be that way, right? But at the end of the day, I'm a big believer that all that we're supposed to do in life is figure out our maximum potential and then try to get as close to that potential as we possibly can. And if my potential is down here and your potential is up here, I don't need to worry about that. Because all I need to do is get to my maximum potential. And as I've focused on potential throughout my life, it's been a massive differentiator. You get out of the comparison game. You get out of the, oh, am I keeping up with their career path or their career path or their family path or whatever, and just focused on being the best version of me that I can be. And again, I think that, I don't know if I was drawn to sports because of that mentality or if sports pulled that out of me, but I think that there's some sort of connection there.
Yeah, and you think about our life and this journey that we're on. Well, hopefully by the time, you know, we're kind of done in this journey, we'll have found the thing that we're just, like, gifted at, right?
Yeah.
And then when you start pursuing your potential and the thing that you're most gifted at, that's where just the skyrocket.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Okay, so college days, what did those look like for you?
Right out of high school, it's important for me to note that I didn't go straight to college. I went actually on a 2-year mission for my church. So I got an assignment to go on a Spanish-speaking mission to Southern California. So I was lived in Compton in downtown Long Beach for 2 years and was able to be there.
Okay, we can talk about this the rest of the episode.
Oh, man, it was such an epic time. I remember when I got the assignment to Compton and I was like, oh, man. Most incredible experience of my life. Saw things and experienced things that I didn't even realize, you know, were going on in the United States. I mean, I grew up on a ranch, you know, with pickup trucks and dirt and you know, whatever, you know, out of the sticks. And now I'm in this concrete jungle and all kinds of things that I saw and experienced and hardship and, you know, humility and just people that were so open to anything that would help them be better, help them to improve and have a better life, and totally changed my life. Most important decision that I made was to give up 2 years and go be a missionary. And then I came back from my 2-year mission and ended up in Provo, Utah at BYU. Okay. And, you know, interestingly enough, my dad was not a big proponent of college. So unlike most parents who are like, one thing you got to do is you got to go to college or you got to keep getting educated or whatever. My dad was, I left this out at the beginning, but my dad was adopted from a German orphanage when he was 4.
Hmm.
And,
is that what led him to adopting to?
Yeah. To a large extent, my mom and my dad were very drawn to that because my dad, really was given a shot. He was taken out of an orphanage by an American family who was serving in post-World War II and brought back to the States. And so, but he, I mean, a very humble upbringing. My grandfather, my dad's adopted dad, it was a very humble upbringing. I mean, he was in the Army and, retired from Fort Hood and Killeen. And, my dad lived in Temple and went to high school there, and that's how he ended up at UT. But he was self-made, He went and knocked doors selling Cutco knives and Kirby vacuum cleaners to put himself through college and, and then got into Amway, worked for Texas Instruments after he got his degree. But there was just something there. So he wasn't really encouraging me to college. So college was kind of, it was a big deal when I decided to go out to BYU. I kind of just felt drawn there. And ultimately, I know now why. And it's because I met my wife there. I would have never met her if I wouldn't have served a mission. And that's why I say that serving the mission for me was the most important decision, because I would have never ended up at BYU and I would have never met my wife, who's the most important thing that's happened to me, for sure. She has completely molded me and shaped me with the good Lord. I needed a lot of work. And so the two of them together have figured this out, and it's been just an incredible experience. So I was out there for 4 years, and then right out of my undergrad, I was planning to go to law school. I thought, actually, my mission president, who I was with in Southern California, was an attorney. He had been an attorney by profession. It's a volunteer deal, so he was volunteering out there and kind of running this group of about 175 missionaries. And I thought, oh, I'm just going to follow in his footsteps. He's an attorney. I really idolized him. He's like a second father figure to me. Mm-hmm. And right before law school, right after I graduated, I went out and my dad had always said, and I did listen to him, not about the college thing, but I did listen to him. And he used to tell me all the time, if you ever have an opportunity to go sell something knocking doors, take it.
Yeah.
Believed wholeheartedly that experience he had selling Kirby vacuum cleaners and knives and whatnot that he did through college really made him into who he was. And so I went out for the summer and sold alarm systems in Philadelphia, the row homes of Philadelphia, right after I graduated from my undergrad, and ended up
Philadelphia. Just the job?
Yeah, just the job. Okay. Yeah. So I was in Utah, and I was part of this industry, the summer sales industry. And anybody that's from Utah or gone to school out there is chuckling right now, because they know all about it. But they go out there and they heavily recruit these college students, and they go out in the summer and they knock doors and they sell pest control and solar and alarm systems and basically all home services type products. And I go out there and I end up having this great experience, and I make really good money, really good money for a college student. And I come out of that summer and I'm like, I think I could start an alarm company. And so that was ended up being my first job, as I started an alarm company out of my undergrad and did that for 4.5 years.
Wow. Yeah, I would say, door-to-door sales, and there's some other industries too where it's just an intense sales culture, right? Like, and I would say if sales is the direction you want to go, it's probably good to do something like that early. So probably paved a way.
It did. And I don't think, somebody asked me the other day, how would you talk about that experience? I just say, everything I have done since then has been easier.
Yeah.
Nothing has ever been that hard.
Yeah.
And so it really was a great way for me to kick off my career in general. It was just doing something that hard.
Well, I think, when you were talking about your wife and really just family, before I forget to ask this question, I want to ask you, and I have just the short time I've gotten to know you, I've got a lot of respect for you. And so I'd like to hear about, the wins, the losses, the challenges around being the father and husband that you are in such a demanding career, right? Being the CEO of a $500 million company is going to be very demanding, no matter what boundaries you set up.
For sure.
And so I'd love to just kind of hear you just elaborate on just the balance of being a father and a husband in the midst of such demand.
Yeah. The biggest win for sure, and the most important thing has been marrying the right partner.
Yeah.
My wife and I truly have strived to do everything together and understand that there's times and seasons. You know, balance is an interesting thing. Some people talk about work-life balance. I don't really believe in that. Work is part of your life, and personal is part of your life, and all the different things that you fill it with is all life. And so it's really just balance. And that's how you described it when you asked the question, which I really appreciate, because that's the key. The key is to recognize that the scale is not normally ever perfectly in balance. You know, when you're at work, you're neglecting your family. When you're with your family, you're neglecting your work. And that's okay. It's just understanding in those moments what you're doing and being intentional about it. And every professional accomplishment that I've had, I have felt like it's my wife and my professional accomplishment. She's been fortunate enough to be able to stay home with our kids since right before our first was born. That was a path she chose, and she was excited to be a mom, and she has found so much fulfillment in being able to do that full time. But that has not meant, in fact, I mean, I love telling this story, but when we went public, when we took Solo public on the New York Stock Exchange, she was right there on the podium ringing the bell with me. That was really important to me. Yeah. And, you know, there's a limited number of people you can fit on that podium, and not all of the employees were super stoked that one of the slots was set aside for her. But to me, it was a no-brainer. She was more likely to be up there than me, from my viewpoint, because all of my successes weren't possible without her. Our kids are our most important thing in our life, and she was so amazing at allowing me to do the things I was doing professionally and still make sure our kids didn't miss a beat and that they still felt close to me. And she just did an amazing job at keeping even me close to them. So, you know, what I would say is this: marry the right partner and make sure that you do it together, that you're making decisions together. I never took a job that she didn't tell me I'm on board for that. It was never her following me. It was always us side by side doing things together. And then the other thing is just recognizing, you know, in our case, we have 5 kids. You know, it's a lot. And my career has been super demanding. I don't have hobbies. My hobbies are my kids. Yeah. And I find fulfillment in that. And, you know, it's not for everyone. You know, you hear people all the time, well, I need my alone time. And I mean, so this is controversial. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are going, no, you can't go hard and you can't do all this without the downtime, whatever. But that's my relief. Yeah. My relief is my family. Yeah. The closest thing that I really have to a hobby is going out and working out every morning. Before my kids and my wife wake up, I wake up early. I'm an early riser. I've always been a morning person. I normally wake up about 5:30, get to the gym and work out for an hour, hour and a half, and then get home and spend time with the family and read some scriptures and pray together, and then go off to school and work and all the different things that we do. So
that's great, man. Because that was going to be a follow-up question. It's kind of some personal disciplines that you have, but I think you just answered it. You know, any other, you know, elaborating maybe on some personal disciplines that you have that you think have kind of led to success for you?
Just trying to, I believe the most important, there's a quote that I heard at church growing up that I still live by, and it's no success outside of the home will compensate for failure in the home. Yeah. And so for me, like, that's just, when we talk about daily habits, it's just making sure that we're doing the best we can. I haven't been perfect. I mean, my wife would be the first to say it, but try to be intentional. You know, my wife and I try to date still. You know, we've been married for almost 20 years, and it's just trying to spend time with just us, trying to spend intentional time with the kids, reading our scriptures on a daily basis, praying together on a daily basis, staying grounded in those things. And then the physical side of it, you know, working out has been really good for me too, from just an overall mental and physical state. But those habits have led to so much success outside of those things. For me, I mean, it's hard to articulate exactly how. I've seen it, right? And we've gone through phases where we've let those things slip and you don't feel as successful, or you're not as successful outside of the home. And then you keep those disciplines and great things happen.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people talk about routine, right? I kind of feel like routine seems harder than the word rhythm, but it seems like you've got a really good rhythm, you know, with that waking up at that time, going to work out, getting that awesome time with your family. And it probably feels like a rhythm, right? When it's, I'm not trying to reinvent it every day. I've been doing it for a long time. It works and it's a rhythm.
Yeah, that's I love the way you're saying that versus routine or habit or whatever, because when you're in rhythm, right, there's something, it's almost, you can hear the music playing.
Yeah.
The other thing that I love about rhythm and the way that you're describing that is when you don't have it, you're more likely to recognize it.
Yeah.
Because there's something about when the beat's off, you know, and you're like, oh, that sounds terrible, you know. And so that's definitely, you know, and you can feel it. We can feel it as a family. My wife and I can feel it as a couple. So it's great. And frankly, you can feel it in business, you know. Yeah. There's some times of the rhythm. It's just going. You're like, man, you know, this is amazing. And, you know, trying to create that rhythm in your life, I think is critical.
Yeah. So your door-to-door sales, give me a little bit of a fast forward to the point that you were at Solo Stove.
My oldest son, who's now 16, was 4 years old, and I'm still in the alarm business. I'm doing door-to-door. I've started my own alarm company, and I'm a few years into that. And, you know, people are at home the evenings and on the weekends. And I've always been more of a servant leader, lead from the front type of leader. So when I had my own alarm company, I didn't just throw my guys out on the doors, door knocking. I was out there with them. And that was great when my first couple of kids were 3 and 1 and then 4 and 2, because they're not in school. So I got to hang out with my kids all day. And then, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, I'm leaving to go work. And, you know, so I'd miss dinner, but I'd have breakfast and lunch with them and all that's great. And I just remember the first Saturday that my 4-year-old son had soccer. It's a soccer game, and I was gone all day. So I just remember, like, I'd leave on Saturday mornings at like 8 a.m, and I'd be gone until, you know, it was dark. And so that was kind of the sacrifice for Saturdays. Well, my 4-year-old son has his first soccer game, and I got home that night, and my wife's like, this isn't going to work. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, you're not missing our kids' Saturday activities for like the rest of time. You're going to have to find a new career. And literally, like,
I like your wife, man.
Like 4 or 5 days later, I go and take the GMAT and put in an application to go back and get my MBA. I didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew that I was going to have to change careers. And I was pre-law before I started the alarm company. So I had a political science degree. I'm like, I don't think anybody's hiring me.
Yeah.
And so fortunately, I got into the University of Texas in Austin and they're working professional Dallas program. So they fly professors up from Austin to compete with SMU's program here in Dallas. And I started that pretty quickly and got into that program. I was still doing my alarm stuff, trying to find balance with some of the stuff that was going on with the kids while also going to school. So I'm like going to school every other weekend for 2 years, Fridays and Saturdays, and then doing the alarm company. And about halfway through that program, well, at the beginning of that program, I'd met a guy named Ben Malin, who's the CEO of MarketScale. And we were classmates. And we just used to always share stories. He was at the time running an inside sales team of like 300 or 400 people. And I was fascinated with the idea of phone sales because you wouldn't have to knock doors. You're in air conditioning. We're knocking doors in Texas. I was hot all the time. And he was fascinated that I was running a 100-person door-to-door sales team. He was like, I don't know how you're getting people to do that. That's insane. And about a year in, we were just both in awe of each other enough that we were like, man, it'd be really fun to work together. And he was nice enough to give me a job at MultiView to start helping out with this inside sales team. He didn't really have a job for me. I think he called me a manager, but I was sitting in a cubicle. I just remember the first, they offered me enough money and I couldn't pay my bills with the salary that they offered. But there was bonus based on performance. And I just knew right out of the gate, I either am going to sell and pay my bills or we're going to go broke.
First of all, Ben and MarketScale, awesome. They're just doing an awesome job.
It's like, amazing.
We get to come. You've experienced it today. Have you ever been on a podcast that they've hosted here?
I have.
Yes,
yeah.
You did. Ben does one. And so kind of fast forward a little bit more to the point, you know, that you're in your last role.
Yeah, so I go from MultiView, and I got a little bit of exposure at MultiView. It was backed by a private equity company, and that was my first interaction with private equity. Mm-hmm. And I kind of became fascinated with this idea of these companies investing in private companies and then growing them and selling them. And I ended up meeting the founder of another Dallas-Fort Worth company. It was actually in Fort Worth, called Claris Glassboards. This is a company that was manufacturing whiteboards but made out of glass, which right now in today's day are pretty popular. Yeah. But back in like 2014, 2015, this was like basically a non-existent. Like it was very small, very scrappy. And they had just taken on a private equity investment. And the founders were looking for a new head of sales. And they offered me the job. And I was fortunate enough to have had a great experience at MultiView and transitioned to Claris. So I did that for another 3 years. So I was 3 years at MultiView and then 3 years at Claris. And we grew that business. And then ultimately in 2018, actually led a deal process to go and sell that to another private equity firm. So we completed a deal around May of 2018. And I really wanted to be a CEO at that time. I had kind of been pegged the sales guy, and I didn't have anything wrong with that. I love sales, and you know, my dad had always told me sales solves all, and you know, I love that side of it. But I just, from my MBA, I just started kind of falling in love with all aspects of business and thought, man, I'd really like to try my hand at more than just the sales side.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the new ownership at Claris didn't feel like I was experienced enough, and they really wanted me to stay, and they gave me a great offer to stay. And about 3 months later, I got a LinkedIn message from the founders of SoloStove asking me if I'd come in and help them, give them some advice on how to scale a sales team. And they had heard that I had done that at Claris, and so I went over there thinking I was kind of doing them a favor. It was just more of a give back. And about an hour in, they said, "Have you ever thought about being a CEO?" And I'd found out at that point that they had heard through the
grapevine. But you already had aspirations for that.
That's awesome. I had aspirations, and they had heard that through some mutual connection. I didn't know those guys, but they knew some people that knew me. And so this was all kind of meant to be an interview, but I didn't know it. I thought I was just helping them out. And 9 days later, I started. And that was October of 18.
Wow. Well, I think, you know, I think people that have a growth mindset can be pegged as sales, right? But I would argue to say the best CEOs probably have a growth mindset, you know? And so I love it that you were able to pivot that way. In the midst of, because that's what I've known of you, the research that I've done of you is that you're a high growth leader, you know? Is that an accurate statement, would you say?
I just love it. Yeah. I love progress. I mean, I don't know if it's coming through or not in my conversation, but not just in business.
Yeah.
I just think we're all here to grow. I mean, as people, right? Relationships, and certainly in business as well, right? I mean, everywhere. The growth is just, I think that's what it's all intended to be. It's just growth. That's why we're on the earth. And so, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I definitely, you know, I've had that mindset in business and in life.
Yeah. I think about growth, and I remember when my daughter grew the most. She had this huge growth spurt when she was in fifth grade, and she was super uncoordinated, like during that period of time when she was growing, right? And now she's turned into this really excellent athlete. Even in the growth of the human body, there's chaos.
Right.
Right? And the goal would be to have less chaos, right? Like during a growth period. Is there anything that you've learned just in your times of growth, whether that's in companies or personally, that allows there to be minimal chaos? Because there's inevitably going to be some chaos, but minimal chaos during growth.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the comparison with your daughter. I'm going to use another word. I'm going to throw another word on top of chaos. And the word I'm going to use is clumsy.
Yeah.
Right? And it's easier to picture, right, from a human standpoint. Our kids have kind of gone through those phases too, where they just kind of, they're just clumsy. Their bodies are trying to figure out what to do with this new growth that they have. And I think in business, there's a lot of that as well. You get clumsy when you grow really fast. And I think that's kind of part of the, you have to kind of grow into it, and you have to figure it out. You know, the biggest thing that I've done or that I've tried to focus on when it comes to growth and trying to mitigate chaos or mitigate clumsiness is to never settle or just sit on your hands. You've got to be moving at all times. And I found that if you just are constantly moving with the growth, you're not going to be perfect, but you can't get paralyzed with growth, because growth requires change. Change is uncomfortable. A lot of times people don't like change, so they want to try to slow things down, but growth is happening over on the side anyway. And if you just get paralyzed and stop moving and stop evolving and innovating, ultimately you're going to stifle the growth, right? And it's going to slow down, and that's obviously not what you want. But I found as you move and as you continue to configure and organize the growth in different ways, that you mitigate that chaos, and ultimately it becomes organized chaos, and organized chaos can deliver outsized success.
And it makes me think about, I'm just thinking about your journey and knowing this high growth mindset that you have, but also knowing you got to a point where you're leading a large organization that has a lot of different personalities, right? And so you've got some people where just growth fuels them, but then you've got some people who are excellent at their job, but that what that growth mindset brings is hard for them to work under, right? Yeah. And so, you know, from a culture standpoint, in thinking about these organizations that are on the larger side that are growing, whether they're growing organically or not organically, but there's still these people that are very valuable that you're trying to prevent like too much of a wake for, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And so I don't know, I'm not doing a good job at asking this question, but did you learn anything, you know, do you have anything to share to the audience that's related to how do you kind of manage or lead these people that where growth fuels them versus the people where growth sucks the life out of them, right? Or is your learning more so like, when you're in high growth mode, you just need high growth mode with you.
Yeah.
You know? So
great. Such a great topic to talk about. Somebody really wise, a good friend of mine told me once, and I think many people have said this, but one of the great arts of business is learning to do more by doing less. Yeah. And I'm just a huge believer in that. And you're spot on. And in fact, I would venture to say that the majority of people in an organization are not naturally drawn to growth
or fueled by it. Yeah.
Because again, back to what I just said a few minutes ago, growth generally means change, and most people don't like change. Mm-hmm. Most people like stability. That is, our natural human nature gravitates towards stability. And the way that I counteracted that as we were growing rapidly, particularly as it pertained to culture, was to center our team around purpose and what that purpose was. It was the constant. It was the thing that no matter how fast we grew and no matter how much chaos there was in the organization that we had to build around, they were able to focus on why, the purpose. It's 'cause that Simon Sinek, you know, start with why kind of mentality, and being purpose oriented as an organization and helping the employees know, even though this is changing and that's changing and that's changing, we're still just going after this North Star. It's that one thing. It's that one simple thing. And all of this is about that. So if you ever get overwhelmed, just think about that and then do whatever you think is going to get us there. And over time, I just found that that created a ton of stability and a ton of calm within the organization. Easier said than done. Yeah. Culture is tough, and culture while you're growing rapidly and hiring rapidly is even tougher. But that was a strategy that I think helped us tremendously and continues to help me in anything that I do in life.
Yeah. You know, I think there's two things that are going on during, you know, high growth. You've got this innovation, because you guys were always innovating, right? you know, obviously started with the fire pits. Did it start with fire pits?
It actually started with camping stoves.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then we innovated around the fire pits in 2016.
Okay.
And then obviously from there,
okay,
a variety of other things.
Yeah. And there's so many products now, right? And so innovation was a huge part of the growth. But then I also think, you know, excellence culture, right? But this idea of excellence too, of not just innovating, but being excellent at what you do during that time of innovation.
Yeah.
And so is, you know, kind of speak to that a little bit. Were there times where you had to kind of stop innovation so that you can pursue excellence? Or did you find the ability, you know, as a leader and as that organization that you all were able to do both at the same time?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. We didn't ever bifurcate the two things. We wanted to foster excellence everywhere in the business all the time. Excellence in innovation, excellence in execution, excellence in fulfillment and operations, excellence in supply chain, excellence in culture and team. So we never split off the two and thought about it like that, like it's a one or the other, or we're doing these two things separately. It was always, no matter what we're doing, we're striving for excellence. But I think where we really went right at Solo, and really throughout my career, it's not just a Solo thing, is what is that North Star? I talked about having purpose or knowing your why. Whatever that purpose is, make sure that your eye is always on that and you don't get distracted with the minutiae of execution in all these other areas. In other words, all these other things that you're doing are really to make that happen, to be excellent at that purpose. And at Solo, that focus is all around the customer. Yeah. It was all about doing excellent for the customer. And so as we innovated, we knew we weren't going to be perfect. We went into it expecting not to be perfect. We were going to fall all over the place, but we had this mentality of you succeed or learn, there is no fail. All that failure is succeeding at learning what didn't work. It was actually a success. Yeah. And so everything was a success. Yeah. We either were succeeding at taking great care of our customers, or we were succeeding at figuring out what wasn't taking great care of our customers. And then we could back off of that and pivot and do other things. And as we did that, that really fostered this idea of excellence all the time, no matter what we were doing.
We've been able to kind of talk about the personal side. We've been able to talk about just kind of what's led you as a leader in your organization. And so, I really appreciate it. I think we're going to have a round two. You kind of told me that you'd love to have a round two.
For sure.
I know there's a lot coming up for you.
Yeah.
And I know there's probably a lot that you can't talk about, you know, in the stage that you're in, but, anything that you kind of like to share as a send off for the audience, for the time being right now?
You know, I think I just would love to just double back for just, you know, 15, 20 seconds on potential and on purpose. It's been such a life changer for me. Keeping that in mind in everything that you do, and regardless of where you find yourself or what you're into professionally, personally, whatever, just figure out. And you said it best, Matt, earlier when you talked about, you know, what you're the best at and figuring that out. And then putting your efforts into reaching your potential in that, and then how much joy comes from that. So that's really been the story of my life, and I've been really, really fortunate to have been blessed to be able to kind of find that at an early stage of my life and go after it.
Yeah. Well, we can only hope the best for you, man. I know it's
going to
be awesome.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of respect over here. And I mean, the journey that you had with Solo Stove and the season, I mean, you just stewarded that season so well. So, you know, I thank you for it because I get to gather around a fire with friends and talk about some good stuff. And so thank you for the time. And I look forward to the next time that we get to hang out and talk again.
Thank you.
And yeah,
likewise.
I appreciate it, man. Welcome to the Excellence Culture.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.